My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. I would like to say to you people standing in the back, there's a lot of seats up here if you'd rather sit down. Just come right in, sit down if you wish. Come, right up near the altar. If you get here on time, you wouldn't have to do this. And for those of you who prefer to remain standing in the half measures hallway, I'm very glad to be here tonight. I'm very glad to be in Moorhead. I'm very glad to be at the Red River Roundup. And I've had a wonderful time here. I've enjoyed it very much. I knew I was in good hands. I got off the plane last night. I didn't know when he was speaking. I would have got here somehow earlier. I don't know how I could have, but she's one of the few Allen nuns I enjoy listening to. I'm not crazy about the advice I get at home, I'll tell you. But I got here. And Rod and Susie were kind enough to meet me at the airport and late at night and come out, and we stood around with my bags, and pretty soon my bags came down, and Susie was kind enough to pick up my big sheaf of papers that I was reading, and Don held the door so I could carry the bags out easily. Thanks a lot, Fred. I mean, Red held the door so I could get out. And I had a very nice time. I enjoyed the meetings today. I went to a couple of the workshops, and the same things always go on for workshops. They always are meaningful, and they sometimes seem boring, but they're always new and indicative of our efforts to learn something. I have mixed emotions about this evening, I must say. Unlike probably everyone else in the hall, I have a ticket for the Olympics in the Coliseum tonight. Your false sympathy doesn't help at all. But I've seen some of those at the opening and a couple of the other events. It really is a... This is not the show. Get that kid out of here. I had a chance to see a little of the Olympics tonight. I knew I was in Moorhead, but that made me feel like I was in Minnesota. I gulped my food, raced out to the corner out there with a group of other people, and we turned on the Olympics, and they had it in his building, and now the big event, the 400-meter relay, the 4x100, in other words, the four fastest American 100-meter runners are running. They're having a commercial before it. It's one of the critical moments of the Olympics to see a Carl Lewis going to get four golds, and some member of this organization, I couldn't read his badge, come up and says, "I guess you don't mind if you turn on the Vikings too soon to do it." I hope the ghost of Bud Grant craps in your hat. We don't judge, we just... It would seem if you were new to have tickets to the Olympics and instead go to an AA meeting, it seems like a bad priorities, but if you get a depression, it's so hard to wait 4 years to get an answer again. You just go around. I'm glad to be here tonight. I'm very pleased that I'm here, and I'm glad to be a member of Sober Member Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to commend the people in that show. It was just a grand show. I really enjoyed it very much, and I don't think anybody else knows, but the guy who whistled the National Star Spangled Banner left out part in the middle. Did you notice that? I think, for those of us who listen to such things, those... That's the part you left out. Does anyone have an offended yet? No, I guess I've done it, though. Sorry. I'm looking forward to hearing Brown tomorrow morning from Saskatoon. Saskatoon, Saskatchewan is a very famous place in the annals of alcoholic treatment. I spoke up there a few months ago, and I mentioned this day or two, and I had to fight my way out of the hall. But in Saskatoon a number of years ago, when I was new around AA, they had UCLA, University of California, Los Angeles, had a big medical school, and they had a big experiment because they thought they had found an answer for alcoholism. And they had a special drug that had been developed at the University of Saskatchewan in Saskatoon. And they came down to the AA club and asked for volunteers to try it. And I volunteered because I was living in the back seat of an abandoned car, and I didn't have any front teeth from my... I said, shit, I was here. And you know that puke wouldn't take me. In fact, I wasn't up to their standards. And so I did not get to be one of the 10 alcoholics chosen that year to try the miracle new treatment developed by the University of Saskatchewan for the treatment of alcoholics. We now know it as LSD. And 9 of the volunteers died as a result, sooner or later, from that little test. So I'm all of them proud to be with folks from Saskatchewan and Canada. I don't hold around personally responsible, but there's a certain national guilt. I used to drink. I guess I haven't mentioned that in my remarks. I used to drink. And incidentally, one thing I like about being in, I've not been here before, and it really is great. I travel a lot, and everywhere you go in America, I'm always a minority, you know. In the East, they have a lot of Catholics. And you go south, and all those Baptists. And you go in the Midwest, a lot of Presbyterians. And in the Southeast, there are Episcopalians. You go to the West Coast, and you find the Church of the Inner Light shining through your left ear. You know how nice it is to come to here, come to Fargo Moorhead, and look around and notice you're not the only goddamn Lutheran on the block. I was down looking at those street signs, Dr. Gudbrandstalen, and all sorts of things. I just started to sing Come to Glenly Goblin in Norway. Just welled out of my... I guess that means it's time for the dance now. But it really is nice to be in where there's Norwegians and Lutherans and people understand truth. We don't clap in the Lutheran church. We just briefly relax our scowl. As I say, I used to drink. And I drank for a number of years. And occasionally I thought I might have a trouble with drinking. But it became obvious to me. Going out to mass, Smith. I just can't tell you how nice it is to know I'm safe at last. I began to drink in World War II when I was just a boy out in the Pacific, and someone gave me a drink, and I held it down finally after bombing it up, and it made me feel like a man. It made me feel like a grown-up. I was 15, and I was from a little town in northern Wisconsin. I had run away from home and lied my age and got the merchant service and was on a ship in the Pacific for Pearl Harbor, my 16th birthday. And I The only way I knew then to feel like a man was to try to hold a drink down. And a number of years later, after a series of things, I'd become much more sophisticated and I'd become much more worldly wise, much more knowledgeable. And I'd get married and I'd raised a bunch of kids and was raising a bunch of kids that had some big jobs. And I was drinking. And in retrospect, I think it's safe to say now, I would have guessed it at the time, that without even being aware of it, I was still drinking to feel like a grown-up. Now, there's nothing wrong with the little pimply-faced cute in the Pacific drinking to feel like a grown-up. But when you're getting old and bald and wrinkled and your children are growing up, you really, hopefully, should feel like a grown-up by now, or else chances are slim. And I had, over a number of years, had a lot of problems by that time. I had examined myself carefully. At that time, I thought I might be the only one in the world who had the intelligence to continually examine themselves. I thought it was a one-upsmanship, but it turns out everybody does it. People like us do it a lot. But I examined myself a lot, and I came to the conclusion many, many years ago that my major problem was that somehow or other, as far as I could tell, I don't know that I actually consciously thought these words, but this is the feeling, that somehow or other, I felt things too intensely. That things were too... I know that other people had emotions out here and talk about it, and I read books on emotions, but other people's emotions didn't seem to be as intense as mine. I just felt things too intensely. I used to check myself out by looking around me, and I'll tell you, and I'm sure all of you have done this sometimes, especially you really do it a lot when you're feeling alienated or when you're feeling less than or when you're not feeling well or when you're feeling as though you're out of sync with the world around you. And there's one thing about these comparatives we all make sometimes, and that is, I can guarantee you, that when you're feeling bad and you start looking around at people around you instinctively to see how you're doing compared to them, you will never see anyone who looks as sensitive as you feel, ever. You will never see anyone who seems to have the anxiety level you have. You will never see anybody who seems to have intermittent insecurities and fears like you do. You will never see anyone who seems to have the form of loneliness you have. You will never see anybody who exhibits the degree of uncertainty that you feel in your throat sometimes. Just that, I'm not even sure I know what I'm doing. You won't see people who seem to resent unfairness as much as you do. And you wonder why that is, and I'll tell you why. Because you are doing something that we all have done and we'll all continue to do sometimes, hopefully less than once. You fall into that pattern of comparing your insides against other people's outsides. I compare my raw meat against their defense mechanisms they spent 30 years building to conceal their raw meat. And as a result, I always wind up the loser, and you will too. It's a hard thing to remember that other people, everyone has their own tigers. But when you compare your bad feelings against their outside, it is obvious my case is different. And there isn't a person in this room tonight who hasn't had that feeling again and again. But my case is different. It becomes such a cliche in AA that when somebody gets up and says it, we laugh at them. Because it's such a cliche. But certainly that is a great mark of all of us. But I carried that flag. My case is different. I'm sure you did too. And I got candidates. I went to my first AA meeting a long time ago. I didn't go to an AA meeting because I thought I wanted to go to an AA meeting. The reason I went to an AA meeting is because the AAs came to take my cellmate to an AA meeting. And I was, you know, he was a town drunk. I wasn't a town drunk. I was just a young guy on my way up. At that time, I was going through a little phase of my life where when I had just the right amount of alcohol in me, I developed a Captain Justice syndrome. I would stride work through the world righting wrongs. And occasionally I'd come upon a policeman making what I considered to be an unjust arrest.
We're going on the ditch. Pick up a fighting jack. So we can have freedom in this country. And some get rid of freedom from fascism. And that means freedom from fascism of power-starved peace in blue uniforms with little tin bars, goddammit. I demand your release, Smith.
And I'll tell you something. On three different occasions, at least, maybe more, I got the policeman to release them. And take me. Yeah. I tell you, it doesn't take long enough before you lose your Captain Justice, sir. Doesn't matter like that, I was turning state's evidence. You better know I'll pay up for some of it. But I was in jail over the weekend for one of my Captain Justice phases. And these AAs came in to take this town drunk to an AA meeting. And you're in a small town, as you well know probably, everything that happens appears in the paper. Everything that happens. You just try to miss the lewd and lascivious if you can, do whatever you can. But the drunk and disorderlies and everything is in the paper. You just got here and you stop and read about you in the paper. You want to go to an AA meeting? I said, sure. Oh, no. And things were a little loose then. They just took us out of jail and across the courthouse and upstairs to Luby's Meat Market on West Grand Avenue and went in this long, narrow room full of burned-out losers, just old, gray-faced pukes in their 30s and 40s. It's like visiting Molokai, for so to say. But some guy's nose is going to drop in his coffee. And I remember much about that meeting. I remember two things. I don't know if I really remember them. I think I remember them. One to the effect of some old fool was standing up at the front talking to him. I drank around the clock for many years. And I've come here. And I just never felt so goddamn wonderful. I really felt for these old people. You know, it's really sad, gotta say. And some other old clown slunk up to me. If you keep going to these meetings, son, your life will change dramatically. Well, I never paid much sense at the time, but I thought it was a true statement, because I was on my way to becoming something in the world. I wanted to be something. I had tremendous drive to be successful. And it's kind of hard to be successful. You've been in jail two or three times. You don't want to keep that on very long. So over the next few years, I went to AA intermittently, here and there. And sure enough, my life changed dramatically. I went to jail 31 times. I went to state hospitals and county hospitals and veterans hospitals, and I often thought, if I had to stay away from this damn AA, one of those pukes must have sneezed on me, you know what I'm saying? But the one thing I always knew about AA, I found it at my second meeting and thereafter. I'm not like these people. And a very simple reason, once I thought about it. Their problem is alcohol. Their problem is drinking. Not mine. My problems are situations and real problems, and problems that deal with reality. I wish my problems were drinking. I've had a lot of problems drinking. But they're fairly easy to elude eventually. You plead repentance and get out of it, or something. But it isn't that way in the real world. So I came to the conclusion that my emotions were somehow awry. I thought maybe caused by the going away to see to LCM. So, well over 30 years ago, I went into psychoanalysis. A lot of people say you shouldn't see a psychiatrist, but I loved it. I just loved it. I've talked about it many times. I discovered things in psychoanalysis I didn't know what I was discovering. I discovered how I'd been psychologically scarred as a youth. I hadn't even known that. Remember, one of the golden memories of my life is when I was a little kid. My mother and father were teachers, and they had to go to other towns to teach, and I had to live with my grandparents. And I just loved it, because I was the only grandson for hundreds of miles, and they treated me like a little prince, you know. Then my grandma would make riches. I'd come around the corner and say, I want some riches! And my grandma would say, oh, we want some riches. And she said to my grandpa, oh, Anton, you're going to get cookie to go with it. That is just wonderful. It wasn't until years later in psychoanalysis I discovered that I really hated the whole experience. I I discovered that I had a deep sense of rejection because my parents had deserted me, and it was terrible at my grandparents' house. And God, I got so upset about that. I resented my grandparents for about a year after that. So I just, you know, you can't scar children that way. I discovered I'd been deprived as a child. I didn't know I'd even been deprived, you know. But remember one day the psychiatrist saying to me, he said, "You mean the same, Mr. Emerson? In 1935, in the little town of Eau Claire, you didn't even have a bicycle?" I said, "No." But I got thinking about it on the way home. I began to realize I never had anything. God, it's just terrible. For about 2 months after that, every time I wanted to throw myself into tearful depression, all I had to do was call up a picture of a little tousled-haired, apple-cheeked, blue-eyed little boy standing on the streets of Eau Claire, Wisconsin, watching his little friends ride their bicycles back and forth. Don't worry about me. I'll go into psychoanalysis. Tears on my cheek. Took me almost 2 months to remember. 1935, nobody in Eau Claire had a bicycle. One kid did. We thought he was a freak. He beat him up and broke his bicycle. I really, sometimes I go to the psychiatrist's office, I have a drink and I think, it's amazing I'm doing as well as I am. Thanks for the life I've had. The only thing wrong with psychoanalysis for people like me, I'm not talking about psychoanalysis for people like me, is it has a tendency to fertilize your paranoia. And the more you learn, the more you realize you've been screwed all along. And it's an old analogy, and I've said it many times, but I don't know any better way to say it. For people like me, being in psychoanalysis is like being on the deck of the Titanic. When you hit an iceberg, everybody else rows away as fast as they can. And people like me say, "I'm not getting off this baby until I find out why this happened." And sad thing is, you may find out why, but it doesn't help you. I know why. It takes a number of years to realize that knowing why is of no value whatsoever until you have a way to get off your own personal thinking ship. Knowing why you're going down is no help. And yet, a lot of people like you and me have wasted a lot of years thinking, if I could just find out why. Knowing why is secondary. You got to be in the boats long before you find out why. Another time I got into metaphysics. I was getting kind of dingy by this time, and I had a head start. At one time, I don't like to brag, but to the best of my knowledge, I was one of six people in the whole state of Texas who knew truth. That's a cold and lonely position to be in Texas. And the other five were crapheads, so we can't. I read a lot of books. I did a lot of things. But the one thing I discovered years and years ago, and I never forgot it, I continued to do it. A few drinks help more than any knowledge. I discovered I didn't need to consciously think about it, but only in retrospect I can think about it. Alcohol has a tendency to fill holes in me that nothing else can fill. It fills holes where you don't even know you've got holes. It just fills holes. And it makes it all right. It's a funny thing, where I live, of course, we get a lot of strange and unusual people in the AA. You don't get most of the country, but I sat in the meeting and watched the lovely screen goddess get up to a meeting and talk and explain how when she didn't drink, she felt unattractive and undesirable. She needed a few drinks to feel beautiful and desirable. You look at this, how would you ever feel undesirable? Just making a difference how you look, it's how you feel. I sponsor a guy who used to play center for the 49ers, San Francisco 49ers football team. And he talks about how before a game, he'd be afraid of his abilities. And me and a couple of guys would have a couple drinks to get that edge to go out and face that nose guard or hit that linebacker, whoever it was, his job was. And on and on. And all of us, I suppose, if we're here tonight, when we think about it, have that one thing in common, that it fills the hole. And sometimes it brings problems. And then you've got to start the battle of fighting the problems to keep them from happening. Without giving up the whole filler, you got to make sure it doesn't splash over. And that becomes a lifelong fight for people like you and me, I guess. You know, we talked about sometimes, early today I was talking to someone about how every day has in common. What the hell do we all have in common here? If you're new, I'm sure you look around the room and get them. What have I got in common with all these people? All from all over, Canadians and people from Minneapolis. Guys, it's hard enough to find anybody in the moon that you feel comfortable. What have I got in common with people? Well, did you all drink the same? No. Did you all go to jail? No. Did you all go to the nut house? No. What'd you do? Nothing. Didn't do anything in common with these people. There's only one thing you have in common with them. It's mentioned in our book. I must have read it 50 times before I tried to sunk in what we have in common. The great obsession of all of us is that somehow, someday, we will control and enjoy our drinking. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many of us pursue it into the gates of insanity and death. That sounds like exaggeration, but it really is true. When you stop and think, very, very few people will ever be sober. I see people dying from alcoholism every day. Most of you don't have that pleasure. I see it every day. You think that would really reinforce you. But there's an old saying about things in the world that's really true. It helps you understand why. And that is that nothing stays wonderful. Nothing is wonderful after you're used to it. That's a hard thing to remember because people like me, and I presume like you, want things to be wonderful and I keep looking for them. Even when you find the relationship with that you know is going to be wonderful and you know it's going to just, you sit and you eat and you reach for the salt and your fingers brush and there's a spark. It's hard to believe that in a couple of years you're going to reach for the salt and you're going to say, give me the goddamn salt. Now, it doesn't get it up. Maybe not in those words, but the implication is there. It's not that things happen bad, it's just that we, people like me, I presume like most people, demand euphoria and love to be a real thing. And love really turns out to be something entirely different, something much more deep-seated that isn't magic. But like nothing is wonderful after you're used to it, nothing is horrible after you're used to it. It's a funny thing. I find myself in the work, going to work in the morning, stepping over the bodies of men dying, and I know they're dying, and I feel sad, but I'm thinking about my office. Beyond, can't believe it. I just want to touch myself. But for people like you and me, pursue this engagement in Sandy and what else do we have in common? We have occasional brief recoveries, followed by still worse relapse. Over any considerable period of time, it gets worse, never better. And the other thing we have in common, we've all achieved something in common, the goal of all of this. We've reached a state of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Now, I used to think that's how you got when you get so drunk. I've come to understand it a little more now, in my opinion. It isn't when how you get drunk. That's how it is when you're sober, after you come off the drunk. You come to a stage of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. You can't even find a justification for your conduct that'll sell you, and in a few minutes you gotta sell them. And it's tough. That's why most successful alcoholic suicides take place when the patient is sober. Drunken suicides rarely work. Sober suicides work. I hope that none of us ever have to do it. I have done it once. And I died, and if the neighbor hadn't found me dead in the car with a motor running and pulled me out of there and beat in my chest, I would have been a gravestone in Texas a long time ago. But, you know, nothing on my commitment papers after that that committed me to the state insane asylum. Nothing on my commitment papers said alcoholic, because I hadn't had a drink for some time. That's one of the reasons I was in that car. Because to hold my job at the university where I was directing an opera, And I needed that job because my wife's pregnancy benefits were tied into it. And I married a Catholic, and that's all she ever knew was getting pregnant. I wouldn't dare say that on the East Coast. Let me tell you, little Lutheran boy, something. If you must marry a Catholic, marry a bad girl. Don't marry a good girl. Because if you marry a good Catholic girl, you are about to become the head of a rapidly growing family. Ready or not. I used to plead to her and say, Charlotte, this is a brave new post-war world. Sure, they're fighting just for freedom. Can't we just both continue? No. Could we just use something for the prevention of disease? They sell them on a vending machine over here. No. She had a priest come by and give me about an hour and a half on a rhythm system one afternoon, which is the Catholic version of birth control. And I listened intently, and I just couldn't pick up that beat. I became a national distributor of small Catholics. Made me crazy. I was in this situation, and I couldn't face it. That college job was my night job. My day job was in an advertising agency. I was writing a weekly sports column. That's a diversity of interest. I had my wife to join me. She just caught up with me with a kid from another town. And 10 seconds later, she was pregnant again. And I was under a lot of pressure. And what happens when you're a drinker? They think your problem is drinking. They don't know it's feelings. And that sometimes you drink too much. You and I understand that. And you start falling into the hands of people who want to talk to you for your own good. And God, they're dreadful. They all say different things, but they have one thing in common. They all have little thin blue lips. Now, this is for your own good. Sometimes they say things like that. Do you think your children would be proud to see you in this wretched condition? And sometimes they say things like, how do you expect to stay part of the corporate team if you're going to act so bizarrely? And the one that everybody's heard, but you have such potential. When you hear that crap and you got to pretend to be interested, you're in trouble. And this guy called me, and the dean of the university said, we understand you've been acting bizarrely. And I run the streets at him. I haven't been acting bizarrely. I've reasoned, but a lot of pressure. But he made me go on the wagon. He said, you must stop drinking or lose your job. And my wife is about 4 months pregnant. I couldn't afford to lose the job for $5 a month. And Jesus, I went through a terrible time. I won the wagon, went back to ANA, and about the 15th time I'd gone back to that. And ANA in Texas is just like ANA in San Francisco, and ANA in Chicago, and ANA in Milwaukee. And your well-meaning old poops are just, well, just proud to have you here. Anyway, I tried them once. I thought, maybe somebody has got some sense. They can't all be stupid. I never told them that. I don't understand this, but I think I'm going crazy. This old guy looks at, well, you keep coming back. Now, that is a thorough answer to a person who is really worried. And I'm telling a group one time, I got a bunch of hot chest up. If I don't tell them by Monday, they're going to garnish my waist, I'll lose my job. Jesus, what do I do?
Well, you turn that over to your higher power.
I tried that once. I turned over to my higher power. My higher power turned over to Sheriff Peter Pitcher. And I got off. Sure. And it got so bad I couldn't drink and I couldn't stand it. And one day I just parked my car in my garage and I found it gone and turned on the motor and went to sleep and died. And when you're really sincere, it seems like you don't bother to leave suicide notes or there's any big dramatic thing about it. If you do that, you want to make people feel bad. I just wanted to get out. And that's one of the great reasons I'm always an alcoholic. I drink out of whack sometimes, but unlike these people, I have real problems and real situations, and maybe the situation is bad, but I don't know how to handle them, and they tear me apart. And remember the psychiatrist, someone before the meeting tonight, said I had the personality of a manic depressive. God, that's a nice thing to tell a speaker, isn't it?
Well, let me tell you something.
In Texas, the best psychiatrist determined I was a schizoid or badly split personality. That's why I was committed, spending indefinite to life in the Texas State Insane Asylum in Big Spring, Texas. Well, whatever else that is, that's a resume buster, I'll tell you. Just right ahead of the resume. But I went back. I was down in Texas a few months ago. My children were with me. I was at a talk down there, and they several of my children on the faculty of the university nearby, so they came over, and I was showing them around the town. I said, here's where we used to live in this little house, and here's where you were born, Susie, and here's where you went to your first mass, and over here is where they put Daddy away. And we went by the hospital, and I told them, I was trying to laugh, but I was half serious. I said, well, I wouldn't find that psychiatrist. If he's still there, he must be old and feeble. I should be able to handle him. And grab him by the shirt front and say, you quiet! You call yourself a psychiatrist? You examined me for 2 weeks, knew everything about me, and determined I was a dual personality? And you put me in the insane asylum? You shouldn't be allowed to be a psychiatrist. You know, Christ hasn't got my personality down to two out of me. My problem has always been this group therapy that goes out in the car when I'm driving alone. Well, I've got to get in that house. I've got to work it again. I'm ups and downs. One spring, I was nominated to be Junior Chamber of Commerce Young Man of the Year in the suburb of Chicago in February. By December, I was playing piano in a whorehouse in San Francisco. I'm not putting that down. That's fun for Lutherans, you know. Oh, there must be a lot of washing up there, a lot of towels there, that's right. A year and a half later, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas, directing an opera in March. By the end of that year, I was directing the Christmas pageant in the Insane Asylum. Not very complex job, but directing. The director's main job was just trying to hold the three wise men off the Virgin Mary. We just want to worship our father. And a year and a half after that, I was working in Dallas at the largest advertising agency in the South. A lot of people thought I'd learned my lesson. I really worked at it hard. I was working on some of you old people, remember these old Elstein Elmer ads for the Borden Company? And I was in February, and by the end of that year, woke up one morning on the floor of the Phoenix, Arizona drunk tank, and the guy just got done kicking my front teeth out. Did you laugh at that? What kind of an animal are you? You can't be alcoholic, you must be a chemical dependent. For my next shot. Just a little word for the best old timers in the group. And I woke up that morning, I vomited down his bunk, and I was one of the few mornings I was really glad I'd ever been in psychoanalysis. Because once you've been in psychoanalysis, you always have insight that most people don't have. And I was so sick I couldn't even move my head out of the way of this guy's shoes. I kicked my teeth out. But I was almost instantly able to identify his problem. I remember thinking, this son of a bitch is overreacting. When you know things like that, you're one up on them already. And by that time, my wife had taken all the children, moved to post office box in Dallas, and I didn't see them anymore. And a couple months after that, I found myself being thrown out of the Skid Row mission in Los Angeles in 86. And said, you stay out of here. You're trouble. And I tell you, I stood the street in a T-shirt and a pair of pants and an old pair of tennis and my no front teeth and sick and desperate. And if a guy would have come by and put a lie detector in my arm and said, "Are you an alcoholic?" I would have said, "No, I wish I were, but I'm not." And that needle wouldn't have quivered. Because there's two things. Alcohol is not my problem. And there's one other severe problem that I have that keeps me even from going to AA and trying it. Because AA is a stinking religion. It's a religion. I wish it weren't, but it is. My problem is not alcohol. I have a lot of drinking now. I can talk about drinking. I don't mind going to AA if I'm around drinkers. But all of those religious people get you, and it makes you crazy. And I'll tell you, religious people to me, I used to envy these people that I didn't have any religious education as a youth, but I found God here. And I think, boy, you're lucky, pal, because I already know about God. I learned all about God when I was a little boy. And I know, you know, and I say, I don't know where God lives. I know where God lives. He slowly circles the Our Saviors, which are in church in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And he gives it to sinners and Catholics. And, you know, there's 10 big ones on the wall. If you break any one of those, you're gone. And there's a shot when you don't have to read them. You broke four already. All you can do from then on is break the rest and stick with the ones you like. I sometimes think I've broken all the commandments at one time or another in my life, but I happen to think there's one commandment, one part of one commandment I have not broken yet. I hope I never will, but living where I do, I can't tell. I may break it. But up till tonight, I have never coveted my neighbor's manservant. No promises about tomorrow. We were joking about that during the show. You know, California is the place, and most of the groups in the world, they use the 12 steps to separate the men from the boys. And some of our groups, we also got to get them with a crowbar. But I know all about God when I was a little boy, and I'll tell you what. And I want to hurry up and add, it is not the fault of the Lutheran Church at all. It is the fault of a distorted mind who puts too much depression on things. But by the time I was 12, I knew I was damned. And from then on, it was just a... And you can't live feeling damned to hell. You just can't. So people have different defenses against it. And they sometimes try to fool God with prayers. "Don't believe your eyes, God. Here's what's really going on." Some people try to do overt good works. Some people like me become imitation intellectual atheists. And you go through life, "There's no God." Sit around living rooms with other goofs. And you go, "If God exists, let him strike me dead." "If God exists, why does Lucky Luciano live in Naples with money and God and anything booze and anything he wants and luxury, and 90 miles away the Pope, God's vicar on earth, dies screaming in agony with cancer? Is that God in action? Is that what you get for being God?" One time we were getting so cute in Dallas that we almost got this cue. That somebody caught it at the last minute. It just broke my heart. But we're going to sneak into the phone book a dial-a prayer for atheists. Well, you dial this number and nobody ever answers. It's not an easy life when you're terminally cute. But you know, AA is, some of the guys, some of the girls, but sooner or later that religious stuff comes in there, you know. And sit in the meeting and tell how you feel. I just can't agree with God. Sooner or later, some old lady in white tennis shoes will come up and say, "Oh, Sonny, we hate to see you fight God." That's all. All I could do is keep saying, "Well, ma'am, you'll never see me fight God again." Now you can just hear it for a while. So I would be eligible for AA membership except for one of two things. First, I'm not really an alcoholic because my problem is not really alcohol. Secondly, if sobriety depends upon the grace of God, I cannot stay sober. I hear people say it. You heard it tonight? Man of Wood, chapter 5. Into the grace of God I've been sober. I've heard it all my life, in and out of AA, through the grace of God, and they meant it. There's even a slogan in AA there, but for the grace of God, go I. In other words, I got the grace, and He does it. And I'll tell you, and then that kind of a choice. I don't place myself with a man saying, I have to place myself with a guy who's left out. Because if God is going through the world saying, you can stay sober, you can't, you can, you can't, on a whim, I know I'm going to be out. So, that's why it's kind of amazing tonight to find myself coming here at tremendous inconvenience, great deal of financial unhappiness, giving up the Olympics, even a 400-yard relay, just so I can stand here tonight and say a funny thing happened to me on the way to the insane asylum. I got so sick, I put myself in the hands of these AA pukes one too many times. And they warped me. And now it's been something over a quarter of a century since I've had a drink or a pill or any marijuana. It's kind of funny, this day and age are still little clusters of pukes, weeds along the road of a happy destination. We're still here.
Hey, man, the book doesn't mention pot.
It mentions people are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. That's close enough. In fact, it's kind of funny because they come around, and I don't blame them. If I were their age, I suppose I'd do it too. But they look as though they're some kind of a desperado. I smoke a little pot, man. And I slick. Makes me yawn. Makes me yawn. You should have been smoking marijuana 30 years ago with some of us, where if you got caught, it was 5 years in the state penitentiary. Then you smoked with excitement. Now you get a ticket. Big deal. Our hats are off to you. My hair is off to you. And thank God I haven't allowed myself to fall into the hands of any of those well-intentioned but lethal members of the medical profession who still believe that problems like mine are caused by a Valium deficiency or a shortage of Librium or Darva. I've many chemicals in my body stronger than aspirin from 1958. And I've come here to talk to you new people and ask you this important question. Why can't you recognize your problem the way we did in the old days? I want to briefly talk about these two things that were my great problems. One I talk about all the time, one I've never talked about. So I'm going to talk about them both tonight. It won't take long. How can I be an alcoholic when my problem isn't alcohol? I walked into the AA club, and I'd been banned out of for stealing the coffee money. Just alone. And I was alone a lot, I'll tell you. And I finally got in there, and it was so bad that I had to lurk around there. And I did not believe I was an alcoholic when I was drinking. I did not believe I was an alcoholic when I got sober. Didn't believe I was an alcoholic after I got sober. I have a lot of problems, deep psychic problems, but none that are fit, simplistic answers. There really is no answer. These steps are no answer. What problem should they answer? I'm cursed with memories and regrets and what might have been. And somebody says, why don't you take your inventory? Maybe you'll remember some more. They want me to write things I wouldn't even tell my psychiatrist if I said. I was just nervous about what I told my psychiatrist. I trusted him. I didn't want to take any chance that he might say, what did you say? Get out of my office, you sick son of a bitch. I told him what I thought he needed to know, and that's all he made up. Yeah, I'm supposed to write things, then read it to somebody, some plumber. Mr. Gordon, funny, you still like me, Jim? Yes, I do. Now, you wait till you hear this. Is it going to give me a spiritual boost to have some blabbermouth know that I used to be married to a sheep outside of Butte, Montana? I want to hurry up and add, that's not from my inventory. That's what we call a figure of speech. I never went to Butte, Montana. Ask God to remove all your shortcomings. What does that do? So you can get there with all the people you've hated, get your own little thin blue lips. I don't believe I'd care to do that. That looks like fun. Make amends to people who've been throwing it into me for 30 years. Here's $10 for calling the police on me that time. Meditate. That's a great step for suicidals. Just sit and think. Think for about 3 hours in the dark, preferably. Have your pistol right along with you. Just AA steps seem to have no application to complex problems. How can you be an alcoholic? And one of the great problems I had, I fell into the hands of a bad sponsor. You know, they always say, hey, get a sponsor, get a sponsor. And I'll tell you how to get a sponsor. You go to meetings, you try to find someone who says, I have non-judgmental love. I love you just as you are. You need not change from my love. But you better watch them, because they even they judge after a while. They say they don't, but they get upset. Then you try not to talk to them if you can help it. Use their name. And then the only time you talk to them is when you call them up at 2 a.m. finally and say, hello, Fred. I'm afraid I've let you and AA down. I drank. Now, if you've got a good sponsor, you haven't let us down. You're sick. You've had a relapse, that's all. I'm coming right over, and I'll get some of the guys. We'll go sit up all night with you. And if you need some money, let us know. We'll get you through this. Now, that's what I call a sponsor. I had a number of them, and I loved every one of them. I'll tell you, I couldn't get a decent sponsor in Los Angeles. I guess there were some around, but they were too busy for it. I got some old puke who didn't understand sponsors. Puke said things to me like, Kim, you call me anytime you want, a day or night. If it's late at night, it better be important. Call me anytime you want to, up until the time you take a drink. Once you take a drink, save your dime, because all you're going to hear from me is a click and a dial tone.
Jesus. This guy don't know nothing about AA.
I mean, I left around about a month sober, sitting in the back seat in the car, you know, in the AA club parking lot, so there's a certain spiritual fallout, but... And I was t-shirt and cold and hungry. And I was going to do this. Bob, I'm never going to have any time, Bob. I'm cold. I'm going to throw my best success on the award-winning writer. I've been a good athlete. I think it. Bob, what am I going to do? Yeah. Get a job. I said, Jesus, look how terrible I look. Get a terrible job.
That is not graceful living, boy. I followed that instruction. I've had a rotten job. It stayed so bad so long. I let that old puke got me to do things I'd never do. He did. I'd do anything to get him off my back. Anything. I worked with every job. I went to work every day because he'd see me in meetings then. You got to work today? I tried it. Once tried it out. Oh, Bob. I got up this morning and I got to think about my kids all those few years and how much I've lost. I couldn't face going into that job. It just...
I want to get out! Get out!
Some mornings I couldn't bear to go to work, but I'd still go to work just so I could see him at night. He'd say,
can I work at
night? Yeah, I mean, you have to go. I fixed him. But somehow that I survived and did things I didn't even understand or appreciate or agree with for a while. Went to meetings all the time, you know, if I'd have to go, lived for a while on cake and donuts.
And I came one day, little by little, three times, came to learn something that is the touchstone, I believe, of my survival. And it's just this. I'm glad that I survived long enough. Because a lot of people don't. Some people stay sober for years and never learn this. But I'm glad that I survived. And I want to say this. It's going to sound very upside down, so I want to say it very slowly. I had to come to understand that if I'm an alcoholic, my problem is not alcohol. Or conversely, if my problem is alcohol, I am not an alcoholic. Now, doesn't that sound upside down? But I firmly believe that's the premise of everything we do here, the premise of Alcoholics Anonymous, is the premise of my survival. I bet my life on it every morning. Now, how can that be? Everybody knows if you're an alcoholic, your problem is alcohol. And you get over it by stopping drinking. You even hear speakers who sound like that. They say things like, "When I was drunk, it was just terrible. And I got sober, it was just wonderful. And I got drunk again, it was just terrible. And I got sober again, it was just wonderful. And I got drunk again, is it? You want to say, why do you drink? See? Guy like you shouldn't drink. But I'll tell you something. If you are one of those people whose life is terrible when you drink and wonderful when you are sober, you have no business being here. It's your guest. You don't need to be here. You're wasting your time. What you do is when you stop drinking, that's the name of that game. Just go live comfortably ever after. Why sit in smoky rooms? Why listen to all the baloney? Just, if your problem is drinking, I've got a solution for you that's going to revolutionize your future. Don't drink. And that's the end of that, too. But if it turns out that you suffer from what I suffer from, the chances are astronomically high that you will go to your grave and never know what the hell was wrong. It's one series of bad breaks and misunderstandings after another, new dreams that collapse, sometimes with a roar and sometimes with a whimper, new thoughts that are going to be changed, and it always goes back to the same old crap. And eventually it just gets back and worse, terrible, and the pressure's around, and the loneliness comes back, and the anxiety and the tension, and like they say in athletics, a hand comes out of the shirt. And boy. And I'll tell you, that's where you get. You know what causes that? Not alcohol. Something that sounds like alcohol, and we talk a lot about drinking here, but it's not alcohol. It's something called alcoholism. I say, what's the difference between an alcohol problem and alcoholism? Simply this. If you have an alcohol problem, you overcome it by getting sober. If alcohol were the problem, detoxers would turn out winners. Hospitals would turn out winners. Treatment centers would turn out winners. Toilets would turn out winners. There aren't very many people here who haven't gone through the classic American detox. They can talk all they want about treatment centers and hospitals, but still the number one American detoxification facility is free. You kneel in the morning in front of a porcelain altar, and you gaze and look into those shimmering waters and wait for an answer to surface. Say your morning prayer.
Oh, God.
Hardly anybody's got any gratitude if they're doing that. Somebody should say, "Mabel, come on in. Look, I'm getting a free detox.
Yeah. Won't have to put this on the insurance."
Yeah. Some mornings when you're sick enough, your body will detox you from both ends at once. Good for your body, bad for your nerves. You know? Not only are you terribly sick, but you're called upon to make a series of split-second decisions. And every answer must be correct. There is no margin for error here. But you can get sober. That's what your alcohol problem. That's how you solve it. In this strange, debilitating, denigrating, deadly, wretched thing called alcoholism, there's one tiny difference. Stopping drinking has no effect on alcoholism whatsoever, except to make it more painful. That's all. So ironic, sobriety is the painful end of the disease of alcoholism. That's why alcoholics will eventually drink or take pills or smoke marijuana or do something to relieve the pain. There's a certain surge when you first get sober because you're making it all better, but it isn't long after that till the pressure comes on. And the intensity starts to come back, and the nervousness, and the feelings of being different. And things aren't going to work out, and people really don't care, and people don't really love me anyway. And it's just a bunch of crap, and I'm trapped like a fly on flypaper, and just, you know, and you get to a point one day where you just can't stand it. In fact, scientists who study alcoholics say that alcoholics get to a point where they literally must drink to preserve their sanity. And yet if you drink, they say you'll go insane. That's why nearly everybody who has alcoholism dies from it. Because even if they lay dying, they can prove alcohol was not really the problem. I wish it had been, but not really. Unlike them, I have these feelings, and these what might have been, and these if only, and these searing memories, and all of these things that just make me destroy. Alcoholism is a dreadful thing. Now, the funny thing, there are hundreds of thousands of people who get just like that who are not alcoholics. They're known medically as intense or acute neurotics. They feel just as badly as you and I ever feel. They get intense, they overreact, they become obsessive, they see reality as it is, and it's just terrible. They get to a point where they may snap, and they usually go to the doctors, and doctors sedate them with Valium and Darvon, all the sedating drugs. Because if they don't, they may snap and become what is known as psychotic. And the difference between psychosis, is, roughly speaking, is that your perception, your mind makes your perception of reality change in order to ease the conflict. You don't see it as it is anymore. It fits what your mind can see. Now here's the funny thing. Alcoholics almost never become psychotic. Isn't that funny? The cases of alcoholics becoming psychotic are infinitesimal. But you say, alcoholism is the second greatest cause of insanity. But not for that reason. Alcoholic insanity is more of a physical problem than a mental problem. I'll tell you how it works. When you've drunk enough alcohol long enough and varies from body to body, you eventually desiccate or dry out enough brain cells. And alcoholic insanity is when you've now dried out enough brain cells so you can't function anymore. People with alcoholic insanity are not sitting in meetings talking silly. They're not acting funny at the coffee shop. I'll tell you what, people, I'm sure most of you have never seen a case of alcoholic insanity, and I hope you never do. I see them a lot, and I want to cry. People with alcoholic insanity sit in chairs around beds in institutions. People come and change their diapers three times a day, and feed them, and put them to bed, and get them up, and change their diapers, and feed them. And they can never, ever, ever get better. Ever. Because brain cells do not replenish or recreate. Very similar to the last stages of syphilis, except for one thing. Syphilis has the decency to kill the patient. You can stay in that condition in alcohol insanity for 40 years and never know your name and just be a drag to everybody you ever know. But alcoholics never hardly become psychotic. Why? Because when it gets bad enough or long enough, they will drink alcohol and relieve the pressure. So it begs the question, why don't these neurotics drink alcohol and relieve the pressure? And they do. But it doesn't relieve the pressure. That's why they're not alcoholics. To be an alcoholic, two things must be present. Sobriety eventually becomes untenable. And secondly, alcohol has to have a special effect on you. What is that special effect? Keeps you drunk all the time? No. No human body can stay intoxicated 14 straight days and nights in a laboratory, to say nothing on the street. Is it that makes you crazy? Not at all. I see people die every day who aren't acting as bizarrely as I am walking by on the sidewalk, really. It has another effect, one I never would have guessed in 1,000 years if I hadn't come here. Alcohol has to do something special for you that it doesn't do for most people. And nobody ever knows what it's doing it for. What does it do? It must almost instantly alter my perception of reality. It must almost instantly alter my relationship to my environment. It must almost instantly make me larger and more self-contained, and then smaller and less frightening to me. And if it does that, there's nothing like it. I'll tell you, alcohol on an alcoholic works better than any drug I know on anybody. And I've known a lot of druggies, I'll tell you. But heroin, this terrible thing, heroin, very addictive. What does it do? It pulls you down. Eventually, it grays you out. The conflict is gone, but you're alone in a gray room, boy. Just, cocaine, big thing out of our area, in my area, very expensive. It makes them very high, very nice. See the hole in my nose? Yes. But they know they're up there. They know they're up there. But alcohol on an alcoholic has an effect not known to any drug. It puts you right in the middle of things. High. Do you know any drug that can take a suicidally depressed man and in 10 minutes that same man can be saying things like, "You with anyone, Granny?" Alcohol gives you a different perception, okay? I remember doing this, I'm sure some of you don't. Sit at 9 o'clock in the bar at night. I'm going in there tomorrow, and I'm going to tell that old son of a bitch, Carlson. Carlson, you've been bleeding me on my ability for months and taking credit for it. You underpay me, you treat me like some kind of pig, and I'm sick of it. You better get yourself another boy, son of a bitch, because you're not going to be bleeding me anymore. I'll tell him that, and that old son of a bitch will turn white. That's why it's at 9 in the morning. At 9 at night. 9 in the morning. There's no place. I'm just calling. Alcohol makes alcoholics. It fills holes that nothing else does. And the reason that's important to know is that you begin to understand that being sober is not the answer here. If getting sober were the answer here, you could be like these people who go to treatment centers and think they're cured and wonder why they're dying. Being sober is the entrance to Alcoholics Anonymous, and taking a drink is the exit. There are no drinking or loaded AAs. It's what you do here after you are sober to alter your perception of reality that AA is all about. There's a funny thing here. On any given day of your life, being sober is enough. But overall, sobriety is not enough. Isn't that a funny thing? Now, so if you can accept the concept, maybe, that you've got to do something after you are sober. Being sober is not worth a pitcher of warm spit by itself. It really is. If it were to be, it would be a magic act. Now, but you go to AA. Okay. And everyone comes here, everyone I've ever seen, I've listened to maybe 200 inventories in the last 25 years, 24 years. And there's one thing that's the thread in every inventory, whether they recognize it or whether they see it later. But every alcoholic I've ever known has suffered from a couple things. A deep-seated lack of self-worth, sometimes masqueraded by an arrogance that even fools the patient, but it's there. The feeling of not being quite enough by myself, and guilt for what I have done, or more likely, what I have not done. There's a lot of other niceties to that, but that's true, but all told truth. So you're driven here, and you want to do something about it, and you want to make life better, and you want to feel better, like old-timers who get up and laugh and jolly and feel secure, and you want to feel loved, and you want to feel a part of something, and people tell you, but when you don't like yourself, you can't believe it. You can't even respect people who like you. If I can fool you, I can't respect you. Funny thing. And then you get here and they talk about this God. And there's the ultimate paradox in Alcoholics Anonymous. They say in one breath, the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous will make you better, give you what you need. And in the next breath they say, I am sober through the grace of God. Now what is it? Is it the actions of AA? Is it this God's grace? Is it some sort of a celestial lottery that you have to play? What the hell is it? I could not. Remember a guy told me my first year this time, you're going to have to return to God. And I said, I'm going to tell you something. I can't return to God. And I'll tell you something else. I never have. I remember my sponsor telling me one day, you're going to have to find a higher power. I said, I just don't live in a higher power, are you? And I really wouldn't. If I died, I couldn't do it. He said, do you think I'm doing better than you are? I said, I guess you are. I'm your new higher power. And he became my higher power. And I could accept that. Now, a lot of people today say, you can't have your sponsor or some human as your higher power. I want to tell you something. You better believe in whatever it is you can believe in. Not what somebody else can believe in, what you can believe in. It's easy to get up. I did it for years, drinking and sober. You have 40 of them. I found God through a wonderful program. I don't know. I didn't believe a word of it, but it made me look good. And it gets to be 2 o'clock in the morning, and you feel alone, and you've got to turn to what you believe in, and you've been shucking them, and you don't believe in nothing. Better to have a man out there by God or a woman that you can believe in and call up and say, help me. As a result of trying to do things to get this old fool off my back, I got some self-worth, not much, but a spoonful. And I got to finally come to believe in AA as my higher power. And then someone was kind enough, my sponsor, another man, to point out to me that nowhere in AA does it ever say return to God or return to a higher power. Anywhere. There's only one place in all of AA literature that talks about returning to anything. And as he explained to me, your place that says that, says you may want to return to normal living. And in your case, that would be impossible. Cruel old bastard. True, but cruel. Says you come to believe in something. You came to believe in a power. You got to do it as you get here. You come to believe in something. Put aside these distorted childhood perceptions of everything. And I guess somewhere along the line, one day I found myself praying to an abstract being. And for many, many, many years now, I have believed earnestly in God. And I prayed to him. I tried to do things. And someone was talking to me a few months ago down in Texas. And another part of it in Dallas. And someone was saying to me, but the one thing I always liked about you, you never pushed God down our throat. You talk about action. Nobody around here talks about God. I had to explain to him. I had to stop and think, what is it that I believe? What is it that I think? How can I believe in God and push actions? And I came to I finally examined what I believe. I mean, I must have examined it before, but I tried to phrase it to somebody else. I had to come to believe somewhere, some years ago, without being consciously aware, that this grace of God was not selective. That's a big hurdle. That God's grace falls on all, the just and the unjust. When I stand on the sidewalk today and watch a man die in front of me while the paramedics push on his heart, I got to remember, God's grace is as much on him as it is on me. How can that be? How can God's grace be far than everybody when these bad things are happening, I'm watching people die, and I'm feeling good? It looks to me like I'm being selected by God. Not true. I don't think that's true. If I thought that was true, I'd be dead. God's grace comes upon all. And through God's grace, I'm here tonight. If I were dying on the street, I'd be dying there with God's grace. Very similar to that TV that I was trying to watch in here earlier tonight. Whoever changed the Viking game, I hope you lose. I don't have to hope that. Yeah. But anyway. The Olympics are coming out of Channel 6 here, I notice. Whatever that station, I don't know the name. But they've got a transmitter over here. And it's sending out the picture of the Olympics to every TV set in the Fargo-Moorhead area. They are not sitting there saying, we'll send this to the Sonys, but not to the Zeniths. Screw them. And we'll send it here. That picture is going out to everybody. There's a lot of sets out there that aren't turned on. Then we've got any Olympics, huh? What do you mean, Olympics? That's just 100 glass, sir. Some got it turned on and screwed up. The sets are screwed up. Howard Cosell looks good. But that picture is clear as a bell going out to every TV set. It isn't being received very often, but it's going out there. And that's why I have to come to believe the grace of God is sent out to me. Now, in my belief, it's sent out to you and everybody in the world. You know, that's my belief. God's grace is a picture for me. It's not a picture of a guy running over a hurdle. That's a picture called peace of mind, or serenity, or love of my fellow man. Whatever you want to call it, or you can call it anything you want to call it, God's grace. And unfortunately, people like me, who have found euphoric release through chemicals, find I have somehow, when you do that, other people do it too, but we all do it. Get into the we provide our own interference in that cycle. And I have to take the actions of AA to get that picture. Now, why would I take the actions of AA to get a picture of God coming through all along? It's just the same thing as with that TV set. You know, you'd have to understand it. When the pictures on that set are going, I know to turn the vertical hold. I have no idea what the hell a vertical hold does. If somebody said, what are the electronic components of your vertical hold? I don't know what a tone intensity button, how it works like that. I know what it does, and on and on. And I have found that the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life are very similar to the knobs of the set trying to get a picture of God's grace. I don't like it. Today, I think I can, but for a couple of years before I believed in it, I prayed. I prayed every day. And I noticed when I turned that knob, it made me feel better. The picture got clearer. When I take the actions, when I try to do these things, they're knobs. And some of you don't understand how they work, but they make the picture clear. I'm not here, if you're here cynical and feel less than or feel intellectually superior to God, I don't blame you for that. I did too. But I'm trying to tell you, I'm trying to help you find a solution to a paradox. You don't have to call it God's grace. You can call it serenity. You can call it peace of mind. You can call it a oneness with self. You can call it whatever you want it. But I know one thing, the actions of AA are what enable people like you and me to get to it. And since we are human, as soon as we get there, we'll screw it up and have to do it all over again. No matter how hard you work the program, you never rise above human beings. And human beings have a tendency to say, I'll bet a half a turn would make that better. I bet three turns would really fix that son of a bitch. And every so often the set goes off sometimes. You have to call for help. What do I do? And the repairman or sponsor, as he may be known, you're either a dumb bastard, you've got to turn off again. Whatever it may be. But I believe this, and I don't believe this to believe it. I'm just talking to those who might be worried about that paradox. I find myself when I'm in Wisconsin, not so much more because my parents are old and dying. But until a few years ago, last time I went home, I was so proud to take my mother to Lutheran Church because God's grace was in the Lutheran Church. They have to hate it. God's grace is in the meeting hall in Los Angeles. God's grace is where I work. If I'm turning a knob, if I'm not turning a knob, there isn't God's grace anywhere in my perception. So, the continual battle. That's why I'm active. Tonight I was thinking, young man said, and he was new that somebody came and helped him during the show. He went to a meeting every week, whether he needed it or not. And that's kind of shooting on my spine. I go to meetings three or four nights a week. That happens over 25 years. I'm not saying anybody else should. But I just am used to comfort. I have nothing to prove to anybody. I'm used to comfort. I said nothing, I feel good. When I asked up here and I discovered I had a ticket for the Olympics, I said, what is your question about it? There should have been, but there wasn't. I love sports. I love all those things. I'm involved. Listen. It's not being a matter of good. It's not being a matter of a dedicated man. That's all baloney. It's a matter of something more important than that. It's a matter of, God damn it, I want a clear picture on that set, whatever it takes to get it. That's what I want. I want, and it never stays perfect, because I'll screw it up again and again, and my fallibilities, and my fatigue, and my emotionalism, and my errors. Sometimes I get feeling so good. I get on that freeway in the morning, and I just, doing good. And some old lady will say, see the boy in the blue car? He's feeling good. I'll fix that son of a bitch. But I've learned through AA, I never chase her past my exit. If I ain't got her right, I give her a pardon. Get you tomorrow, honey. And sometimes I'm ashamed of myself because I get tired, and fatigue makes cowards of us all, as they say. Sometimes we get cross, and sometimes we're mean to our children we love, and sometimes we're cross to the people that love us, and it's just sometimes you think, will I ever grow? Will I ever get better? I thought I was doing better, and I screwed it all up. And then you got to turn another knob and say, I'm sorry. I made a mistake. I'm a goof. Let's try it again. Every so often that picture comes through so clear, it's worth everything you ever did together. I'm glad to be here tonight. I'm glad to be safe and sane and sober. I'm glad the continuing actions of Alcoholics Anonymous have worked at least for 25 and a half years to enable me to get the only picture of grace that I have known. I would hate to give it up. Thank you.